Good evening, and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program on Thursday, November 29th, 2012. I'm your host, David Katzmaier, coming to you live as I do every Thursday night at 8 p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tonight, we're going to be talking about security and protection, what to do in a changing world. We've been talking a lot in recent weeks about the changing world arena, the cycles of change bringing us new things, a paradigm shift in the world. The question then remains, what do we do about it once we know? Tonight's special guest is Sal Lafriere, who is the CEO and president of Protective Countermeasures. You can find his site at protectivecountermeasures.com. Sal Lafriere served as Director of Security and Intelligence Operations for the Office of Emergency Management under Rudolph Giuliani. He was the head of the Protective Operations Unit of New York City's prestigious Municipal Security Section, and he is a retired detective first grade of the NYPD. His previous experience provides him with the background and expertise he utilizes in the leadership of his company. Protective Countermeasures provides private investigation, threat and vulnerability assessment services, and specializes in counterespionage and counterterrorism. The mission is to provide realistic, cost-effective solutions to protect clients against risks and threats. They use confidentiality from Fortune 500 companies right down to the individuals they serve. I've asked Mr. Lafriere to come on and advise us a little bit. If we know that this is an era of upheavals, changing governments, castles crumbling, virtual warfare, what are we going to do once we know that the cycles have changed? So on the line with us tonight is Sal Lafriere. Sal, are you there?
I'm here, Dave.
Sal, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Can you tell us a little bit about what does protective countermeasures do?
Well, one of the, as you had said in, you know, in the open when you were giving a little brief overview of the company, we do a lot of work with threat and vulnerability assessments for both Fortune 500 companies down to the average individual, dealing with the different threats that they may face at the Fortune 500 level. It could be potential espionage. It could be counterterrorism. It could be threats against executives. And then when you get down to the individual level, you know, we deal in a lot of cases with stalking investigations. And unfortunately, lately, we've also entered the arena of cyberbullying and cybercrime, where teenagers are major victims of cyberbullying, as we've seen in newspapers.
Yes, and as we've been talking about how things are not quite as conventional, as traditional as they used to be, this goes from our methods of warfare between nations right down to the neighborhood where you live. It used to be that things were pretty much regimented and formatted in how they would happen, but the techniques of crime and warfare have changed, so the techniques of countering it has also adapting. And the advisements that will come to you as a person on the street, in your home, going to your business, are changing too. Sal, what can we expect in the future regarding crime and or terrorism?
Well, I think, you know, with respect to, you know, crime, for one, I mean, that's something that started at the beginning of time, and that's something that, you know, that's going to be with us. And I think we're going to see different changes occur. You know, as economies change, you wind up seeing increases in robberies and larcenies and cases like that. As opportunities develop and change, you see different changes in the patterns there. With respect to terrorism, I think the thing that we need to understand is that terrorism is here to stay, and that the war on terrorism is really sort of a misnomer, if you will. The ability to be able to effectively win the war is really sort of not the case. You know, I think we need to understand that. You know, when you get into terrorism and you start looking at it a lot more closely, you know, what we're really seeing is more of a syndrome more than an actual target or an actual country or an individual. And, you know, when we have a tendency of labeling things and labeling them as, you know, terroristic events, you know, the definition that's used by the United States Department of Justice that sort of sets the standard, it's the benchmark of, you know, what is a terrorism event, is the definition in and of itself is very broad, very, you know, wide-ranging. You know, there's the old joke about, you know, an ex-spouse being a terrorist. You know, when, you know, things that they've done, you know, in the course of, you know, becoming an ex that have made them become, that have made them become terrorists, you know, right through international or state-sponsored terrorism. So, you know, the one, we need to be cautious of definitions that we place on terrorism, but in general, we're looking at terrorism events that are not only just state-sponsored, but also domestic.
This is happening on all levels, because what's happening in the world where we are moving away from just boundary border disputes between nations who might send their trained armies against one another, we're finding that warfare is something that's transcendent across boundaries. It's a virtual war that's going on, and it isn't just out on the battlefield. This is happening on the street where you live. And it might be state-sponsored, or it could be a rogue terrorist cell, or it could be a lone wolf. So the cloak and dagger characters are not the archetypes that we're used to. And there's been a paradigm shift, and the methods have changed. So our forms of recognition, our preparedness have to change, most importantly, so that we know the difference between responding to a situation and reacting to it. Sal, what are some of the biggest terrorist threats facing the United States today?
Well, I think the depending on who you talk to, my personal opinion on it, I think the biggest terrorist group we, you know, problem that we have today is domestic terrorism. And there are a number of reasons for that. And, you know, for starters, you know, the domestic terrorist, you know, and the best example that we can show, you know, highlight is a guy like Timothy McVeigh. Timothy McVeigh was one that was involved with the Oklahoma City bombing with the Muir Building.
Yes.
When you get someone like that who obviously developed the capability and was able to not only target but execute well a plan and create the amount of damage that he was able to create, and that was just one man. When you look at domestic terrorism, your problem that you run into is that, you know, all of your traditional investigatory methods just don't apply. And what I mean by that is, you know, in large state-sponsored terrorism, you know, when you get someone like a bin Laden or Hussein, and in the talks that I've done literally around the world, you know, I've said this a number of times, and people normally looked at me a little sort of a cocked eye when I would say that when I was involved in intelligence operations, it wasn't the bin Ladens and the Husseins of the world that would keep me up at night. It was the Timothy McVeigh types that would. And the reasoning behind that was, in a larger organization, when you get someone like a bin Laden, you get someone like a Hussein, you know, when you get state-sponsored terrorism, when you get a large organization, and it also transcends not only to just the terrorism, but even to organized crime. When the organizations that are committing the crime is that large, traditional methods work. You can get involved with the organization. You can introduce undercovers into the organization. You can monitor their financial transactions. You can watch the money and see where it's going. You can see what they're buying. You can see where they're spending. You can listen to the communications, so you can get up and you can eavesdrop on conversations, telecommunications, and you can engage them in chat rooms. All of those traditional investigatory methods apply.
Yeah.
When you get to someone like a McVeigh, you don't know that they exist, number one. Normally, people in, you know, in that sort of operational mode are dealing with just a, you know, a couple of friends. You know, and I always equate this to, go back to, you know, high school. You know, when you probably traveled in a small clique of maybe four or five people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a good chance you're probably still friendly with them today. If we would try and introduce somebody new into the group, you would know it.
Yeah.
Right. So we couldn't introduce an undercover into your group, and then we would have to, you know, those type of investigations take years. So you have a tremendous amount of resources, a tremendous amount of time that that's necessary to be able to effectively infiltrate the group. So as you're going through all of that, in a large scale, you can kind of get lost in all of it and get yourself in. In the small scale, with the McVeighs and that, you can't introduce that person. They're not moving a lot of money, so there's not a lot of money to be followed. If you don't know that they exist, you cannot get up on their communications, you know, and you're not getting anything effective from there.
Yeah.
So it makes the entire investigatory process just that much more difficult to get into.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have situations that are a little bit easier. Sometimes, sometimes things will work for you. Like, you know, we see sort of a crossover at times between state-sponsored terrorism and domestic terrorism. Probably one of the examples that we'll use for purposes of this conversation was the Iranian threat that came out a couple of months back.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Iranian president comes out and says that in the event that the United States was to attack Iran, that he wanted folks that were aligned with him to go out and commit jihadist attacks.
Yeah.
And we were looking at a large population out of Canada that had both Iranian passports and Canadian passports. And as a result of the possession of the Canadian passport, would have been able to effectively come into the United States. Now, mm-hmm. to be able to get on top of that and to, you know, to become aware of those individuals and try and, you know, prevent the attack from occurring is something that was, you know, is virtually impossible. So,
yeah.
You know, those are the domestic terrorist threat. Tied to international terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism is big. The other thing that you also have is militia groups that are active within the United States. A great point of reference is if you look at the Southern Poverty Law Center's website, that mm-hmm. particular organization tracks over 1,000 groups that are active as militia groups, or groups that are, you know, potentially hostile to the U.S. And they've done a tremendous amount of research and educational programs. But, when you start to look at the organizations and you start to understand what their reasoning is or what their purposes are for not only forming but also potentially, committing an attack, we have a tendency of looking at it and discounting a lot of it and saying it's just a bunch of kooks. But
yeah.
as McVeigh proved, you know, one kook is all it takes.
Indeed. And seemingly disenfranchised groups of individuals who are aligned with an ideology can rise up in response to something that they pick up on the internet or something that they pick up on the news media, because we're becoming less nationalistic in not just our production, but not as centrally located in our warfare. So someone can not just send out their troops, but can send out their message to the sympathetic ideologues out there. So we're really living in a more virtual world. Not only can you have a Cyber Monday after Thanksgiving, instead of going to the stores on a Black Friday, you can have a cyber summons to arms instead of having a predetermined battlefield where the engaging armies will meet. So you have to be more preemptive, stop crime before it happens. Playing defense means you have to be right every time. They only have to get it right once, isn't that so?
No, that's very true. And, you know, that's one of the, you know, we talked briefly about, you know, paradigm changes occurring. And, you know, the big paradigm change in law enforcement is that, you know, years ago, while you were, in essence, supposed to be preventing crime, what would happen is that you would pay close attention to patterns that would develop. So you would look at an area and you would say, you know, we have 10, 15 robberies that have occurred. What were the patterns? You know, what were the significant issues of each one? And, you know, where was there consistency or similarity in the method of operation? And you would start to look for patterns and see if there was one particular group or person responsible for that pattern. And then you would go out and you would try and find them and eventually arrest them and charge them with multiple offenses.
Yep.
And the idea behind that was that, you know, you would stop a rash of robberies or burglaries from occurring in a particular area. Today, what you need to be able to do is to not wait for that crime to happen. You know, it's probably a very poor example, but, you know, we cannot say that we've had a successful investigation and we're able to successfully bring the attackers from 9/11 to custody, you know, and get a successful prosecution out of it and claim that as a victory when the event already occurred. So law enforcement today is under a tremendous pressure in that they have to be able to stop the attack from occurring before it occurs. You know, you have to prevent it from occurring. And it puts a lot of stress on law enforcement for them to be able to do that, because not only do you have to be aggressive in law enforcement, but you also have to balance that out with person's rights, you know, and understanding what and understanding the Constitution and understanding what, you know, how far you can go and where you know, and what you can do makes it, you know, it's a difficult situation for them to operate under. And, you know, interestingly enough, you know, you talk about, you know, how it's the threats are, you know, are sort of changing and evolving. You know, I think one of the things that we, you know, it's good to understand, and it sort of puts it in perspective of how things are changing and how the enemy changes and adapts sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
When we went into Iraq and Afghanistan and started to bust up the training camps, specifically of Al-Qaeda, the belief at the time was that if you went in and you took out the training camps, you would prevent them from training people who would be able to come to the United States and conduct attacks or go to other, you know, to our allies around the world and, you know, prevent them from conducting attacks. What Al-Qaeda did, very interestingly, was that they actually went the next step. They recognized the problem, they problem solved it. And what they did was they took all of their training material and they put it online. And by putting it online, what they did was they opened it up not just for the individuals that would have been attendees at their training academies, but they also opened it up to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And we saw a great blending between the domestic terrorists and the Al-Qaeda potential operatives started to blend together and recognize that, wow, this is a great opportunity to learn lessons. So, you know, where many years ago, you know, when we were kids growing up, you know, the anarchist cookbook was, you know, the big thing.
Yes.
Today, you have the anarchist cookbook online. And what Al-Qaeda did was they would build a device, they would deploy it, and then they would videotape the deployment and show you the effectiveness of the device. And what occurred out of that was what we call a twofer. And, you know, and the twofer was they got the benefit of showing you, if you build this device, this is what can happen, and people were excited about that. And more importantly, it became a recruitment tool for them. and people started to realize, wow, this is something that we can do, you know, remotely, and we could learn remotely. And that really sort of, you know, created a whole new list of problems and issues for us, because today we're in a currently our situation is a person can be sitting in, you know, on a Saturday night in his pajamas with a laptop on his lap watching TV, and he is as dangerous as the person who walks into a movie theater, to a military base, to a mall with an AK-47 and start shooting.
The world has changed. We've become less physically based and more virtually based in all aspects, both good and bad. And so naturally, we're seeing this in warfare too. And we see this on all levels. Sal, I was browsing through your site at protectivecountermeasures.com. And I see you advise people from large companies, Fortune 500 companies, right down to the individual level. When you see abuse happening in the cyber world for major world terrorists, this comes all the way down to the individual level, too. Victims of cyberbullying. I mean, it's a fractal world. What is great, you see small, and vice versa. So you've actually handled cases with individuals being bullied from personal terrorists on the web, as it were, haven't you?
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, we're seeing, you know, I guess fortunately for business, but unfortunately to the fact that you have victims out there that need the services. We're seeing a marked increase in cyberbullying cases, and I have to tell you that the effects and the devastation that you see is just unbelievable. You know what we're witnessing, and again, unfortunately, you see some of this in, you know, like monthly, you're seeing, you know, topics and stories in newspapers and on news reports of kids who were committing suicide as a result of these terrorist attacks.
That's right.
It's a problem. I mean, you know what, again, I go back to when we were kids growing up, you know, the bully had a face, and he was somebody that, you know, you kind of, you know, you knew, and when you saw it coming, you know, you knew it was coming. You know, what the whole concept of cyberbullying today allows the bully to really be a punk, and to be able to just, you know, put things out there and ruin people's reputations and lives. And, you know, one of the things, you know, while it affects teenagers, and just next week I'm heading out to Long Island, New York, to do a talk to the East Hampton High School, to talk to about 600 high school students about bullying, and then later that night I'm going to be talking to the parents. And it's funny because it's two distinct messages. You know, with the kids, you know, you talk to them about being online, you talk to them about, you know, the dangers that they're going to face. And I call the talk The Dangers of Social Networking.
Yeah.
And I try to explain to them, you know, what are some of the problems and issues that you're going to face when you're online. And I tell them, you know, I can't stand in front of you and tell you don't go online and don't participate in social networking, because that's, one, that's not the way of the world today, and two, as with any teenager, if you tell them don't do it, they're going to do it.
Yeah.
So what we try and do is we try and explain to them that, you know, you're at some point in your career, at some point in your life, the information you're putting online is going to wind up, your folder is going to wind up on a guy like me's desk. And these are the things that I'm going to be looking for and looking at. And one of the things that I'm going to be looking at is what I call patterns and practices. You know, if there's one or two pictures of you doing something stupid, that's, you know, that's just one or two things. But, you know, over a period of time, it gives me an indication of your pattern and your practices of what you're really like. And that could have a negative impact on, you know, a future job or a future career, or, you know, impact you in so many ways, your education. And then when I go into the evening side of it, we talk to the parents. And we give them the same message, but then we also explain to them about the dangers that they face. You know, being online, we see problems with, you know, specifically with women who are coming out of bad relationships, who are going online, who are doing online dating, and wind up falling victim to both stalkers and con men. So we try and talk to them, and we try and explain to them, that cyberbullying and the issues of, cybercrime is not just related to kids or to corporations, but, it touches everybody in some way, shape, or form.
I bet it does. And in your years of experience, Sal, you've seen both the brick and the click of crime, as it were, because you've been trained in traditional methods, and yet you're one of the leaders in advising on the state of the arts today. So what are the activities that concern you most? Is this it? Is it on the web that causes you the most concern, Sal?
Well, I think for the most part, everything that's web-based is really a problem. As we see it today, it's probably one of the bigger problems that we have, because it allows the person to become anonymous. And they can hide behind that anonymity. Mm. And, that makes life difficult. But it also, there's a secondary problem with that, and that is that the laws of our states collectively across the country have not caught up with technology. Mm. We have been able to develop technology at breakneck speed. And we've gotten, where what used to be, science fiction is now reality today.
That's true.
But the law has not caught up with that. And there are people that are out there that are using technology not for its intended good, but to be able to victimize people. So occasionally you see situations where someone will put, post something or create a process or, do something to harm someone, and there won't be a law available to be able to get some form of retribution, back from that person. And that's difficult. And it's something that, we need to recognize. It's something that we need to be aggressive with, and it's something that, we need to have corrected. But I think as we progress with technology, I think this is something that's going to wind up happening more and more. And I'm not overly confident that we're going to get a quick solution.
Well, we need to be more preemptive. We need to be more proactive, and we need to be better informed. We can't wait for things to just happen and then decide on the spot what to do, because what is here, what is there is elsewhere. What is here is elsewhere. And war, terrorism, anything and everything is coming to a neighborhood near you. Folks, you're listening to the Cycles of Change radio program. We're talking about security and protection in a changing world. Do we need to create new locks as new doors open in the changing world arena? We're speaking with Sal Lifrieri of Protective Countermeasures, Incorporated, at protectivecountermeasures.com. Sal, going back up to the world arena again, since the same things are found on every strata of life, what lessons have we learned since the terrible surprise of September 11th?
September 11th was really sort of a watershed moment for emergency management and for the entire industry. I often say that when we went through Y2K and all of the preparations that went into place for that, and on January 1st when nothing happened, everybody said, "Well, damn it, why did we go through this? This was useless." Y2K showed us that we needed to start working on plans and preparations, and it's kind of funny, and to look back today from where we are today to look back then and realize that we never had any of those real plans in place, that the whole concept of business continuity, business planning, just never existed. You know, it was always sort of, you know, in the moment and that's never going to happen and let it go. Well, Y2K showed us that we really needed to do a planning. What 9/11 showed us was that it proved everything that we talked about on Y2K, that you really did need to be able to react and respond and have a plan and to, you know, the realization there, you know, there were a lot of things that, you know, come from terrorist attacks, and there were a whole lot of psychological attack, you know, issues that are boiled out of it. And one of the things, you know, that came out of it was it showed us that we were vulnerable, and it took the attack to us. You know, we've, over the course of years and, you know, in history, we've, you know, there haven't been a lot of wars fought on U.S. soil, and everything has always been overseas. It's much easier to deal with it when it's not in your own backyard.
Yes.
And by virtue of the 9/11 attacks and, you know, everything that's occurred since, you know, we've learned a lot. And some of the things that we've learned from that is that, you know, you can definitely become overwhelmed by an event. You know, there were a lot of folks that thought that because they had a plan sitting on their shelf, and that because they had thought about a lot of, you know, how they were going to react and what they were going to do, that, you know, at no point would they become overwhelmed. And we learned that lesson the hard way, that there are things that are going to occur. Like we just had in the New York region, we just had Hurricane Sandy affect us very, you know, very brutally.
Yes, certainly.
You know, when that's a situation where Lower Manhattan experienced a down by Battery Park, which is at the southern tip of Manhattan, we had a 32.5-foot wave of water come into the harbor and hit Lower Manhattan. When you're hit with almost a 4-story building of water, it's easy to get overwhelmed.
Yeah,
and that was one of the things that, you know, that happened with us. But, you know, what, as a result of that, the things that you learn from that is that we need to be better prepared. You know, with all of the work that we've done, we still have a long way to go. And some of it is in the psychology of how we deal with things, the recognition that it really can happen. But more importantly, that, you know, sometimes bad things happen to good people, and you just got to be prepared for it.
You certainly do. And I believe that the changes that we see around the world actually are cyclic. They're interconnected. And when you see the relationships of everything that's changing around you, you can identify at least the patterns of change, even if you don't know the actual events. Take business, for instance. People are asking, why is the Orient rising in business while we're struggling to maintain some of the territory that we had from before? And the answer often comes back that an American way of thinking is very short term. Look only for the bottom line at the end of this quarter. Whereas traditionally, the Chinese are famous for their patience and long-term planning. Native Americans had a policy of considering what you do today, how it'll affect 7 generations later, and you get the term 7th generation. So what does this have to do with warfare, with terrorism, and with crime? Well, we're finding from the lessons of Y2K in September 11th, that short-term thinking might work in the machine age, but guess what, folks? We're not so much in the machine age now. We're entering into a new era. We're entering into an intellectual paradigm. And sometimes the strong will lead, sometimes the spirit will lead, and sometimes the smart will lead. Brute force was the order of the day in lawyers, guns, and money, the military-industrial complex. But what is the power shifting now, creating new power centers in the world, and changing geographically where those power centers are, comes from the intellectually based planning, the long term, and the patience. This happens in good things, which is business and commerce, but it can also, like any tool, be used for evil. So what can businesses and individuals do, Sal, to be better prepared today?
Well, you know, it's funny you talk about power shift and the, you know, having patience and planning. And, you know, that's the one of the, before I get into what businesses can actually do, I find that sort of fascinating. I mean, I've often, you know, you and I often talk, and in our conversations, I always say, you know, my world and your world are sort of on similar tracks. You know, we kind of peek at each other and kind of wonder, what's the other guy doing? And, you know, what are you guys up to? And I always find it fascinating when we get to one of those points where things sort of, you know, cross over. And, you know, I look at, you know, I'm listening to what you said about, you know, the whole patience and planning. And the first thing that comes to my mind, because obviously, you know, I'm looking at everything and, you know, through the glasses of my world, and I'm saying, you know, Al-Qaeda, one of the things that, one of their greatest assets is the fact that they are incredibly patient and they are incredibly good at planning.
Yeah.
You know, and I often say, you know, if you were throwing a reunion and you wanted to have family members come from around the country to come to, you know, to come to your reunion, you would never be able to effectively get everybody on a plane at the same time to be able to land with, you know, within you know, an hour or two and get them all the same locations that you want them to be in. You know, it becomes a logistical nightmare and you can't do it. Yet these guys were able to plan effectively over a period of years and have that patience to be able to effectively carry that out, you know, virtually flawless. You know, we saw that in 90, you know, with the 93 attack. They realized that, you know, they wanted to bring the building down. They were unable to do that. And they took their time in being very, you know, very patient and going through the planning processes to be able to pull off a 9/11. And that's one of, obviously, one of the other things that's, you know, is troubling or concerning for us is what's next? You know, what really are they planning for? You know, what is the next big, what's the next hit? And as you think about that, you know, and I think any rational person is going to, you know, will recognize that and realize, okay, it's not a matter of, you know, if something's going to happen, but when. Then you run into, you know, the next logical thought, which is, you know, what can the businesses do, you know, to be able to prepare, or what can individuals do, and, you know, how do I minimize the impact? And I think, the first thing that you really need to do is get your head out of the sand and your butt out of the air and realize that it can happen again. You know, it wasn't an anomaly. It wasn't something that just occurred once and will never happen again. Regardless of the definition that you use for terrorism, going back to what I was saying earlier, the reality is it's going to happen. And it may not be with the same force and magnitude that a 9/11 attack occurred, but it still can be, you know, a much smaller attack can be just as effective. And, you know, we've seen smaller attacks that have caused incredible disruptions. And, you know, it's one of those things that you have to realize, okay, this can happen. I'm not going to be stupid about it. I'm actually going to plan for it. The other major fault that we have, and we being collectively as citizens within the United States, is that we have a tendency of relying on the government to help.
Yes.
If you believe that FEMA is the answer and they're going to come and rescue you, I'd love to talk to you because I got a couple of bridges I would love to sell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, FEMA is not that first response. They're not going to come in. They're not going to be able to, you know, to be able to rescue everyone and handle the day. Mm-hmm. You know, what we need to understand in our planning is that at the minimum, you should be prepared for a 3-day stay on your own, and probably 7 days is probably a lot more realistic. You know, we have this reliance upon the government, both for the intelligence information with respect to when's an attack going to take place, and then for the reaction that the government will have to make us whole. And that mindset really needs to be changed. You can't rely on the government to do that. One of the things that, and it's probably worthwhile taking a couple of moments to talk about, when we talk about credible threat information that comes out, you know, you'll see the government will issue a statement and say, you know, we've received credible threat information that X and Y, you know, is going to happen or potentially could happen, you know. And we collectively sit there and we go, okay, so if you're telling me that they're going to blow up the transit system, you know, and one of the train lines is going to get blown up, then, okay, it's going to happen. You know, they have credible threat information. And, you know, can you tell me when and can you tell me what time and, you know, can you tell me who's going to do it? And, you know, that's really a problem. And what you really need to understand, and this will take a lot of frustration out from a lot of people who are listening, if you understand what's being said to you, and that is when the government comes out and says that credible threat information exists, me and you would believe that credible threat information means that somebody came in and said, there are a couple of guys that are going to create this attack, and this is how they're going to do it, and this is when they're going to do it. The reality of it is, credible information comes from the source and not for the particular attack. So if you're, and we've seen this situation happen, and a great example of it was down in Florida a few years back. A person known to law enforcement is sitting in a diner. Two people behind him who he has never met, does not know them, never saw them before, are talking about a potential terrorist attack or blowing up a bridge. The person who overhears the conversation goes back and makes a report to law enforcement and says, I heard two guys talking that this is what they were going to do. That gets reported as credible threat information because the person reporting it was deemed to be credible.
Yes.
So that they believe that he overheard the conversation. That's not to say that it was credible information and that the attack was going to occur. And that's where a lot of the frustration comes in when we hear these reports of we have credible threat information about an attack that, you know, potentially could take place. The other problem is sometimes you hear about these credible threat information that came out of something that had been investigated and was two, three, four months old.
Yeah.
You know, 4 months ago, we had credible information, and, you know, we investigated it, and it came out to be, you know, that nothing happened. That causes a lot of frustration in the average public because they just don't understand what, you know, what's being said.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you have to be able to develop, you know, your own capability to be able to figure this out and understand, you know, okay, how am I going to, you know, what is the real threat, what's the implication, and how am I going to react to it? So, you know, I go back to the original point that I started with. You got to get your head out of the sand. You got to realize that this can happen, and you really have to become adult about it and take the responsibility for yourself.
It certainly makes sense. As terrorism threats and crime threats are becoming more localized, then our responses to it has to be more localized, and our self-reliance has to be something that's more keenly honed, because it's not over there, as George M. Cohan sung about. And if war breaks out, it doesn't mean we're going to gear up our factories like we did in World War II. It means that it can happen to you while you're walking down the street to go to a movie theater to see that film you wanted to see. So, Sal, if it makes more sense for us to be more self-reliant and more localized in our preparedness and our recognition, what should we be watching out for?
You know, one of the greatest programs that's out there that has been started was the "If you see something, say something."
Yes.
And that's a phenomenal program. You know, it's got the catchy phrase. It's easy to remember. You know, and it really kind of says it all in, you know, in a very short, clear, concise manner. You know, often I get asked, well, what does that really mean? You know, what does, you know, if I see something, I'm supposed to say something, but what am I supposed to see and what am I supposed to say? And a great, you know, a great technique to utilize is for those that have children, when you look at your child and the child's up to no good, you know it. You know, when something's not right, you know it. You know, you just kind of, you know, hey, something's not right here, be it that they don't feel good or, you know, more importantly, when they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing, they get that look about them. Mm-hmm. You realize it, you know it, and what you need to do is to react to that. You know, it's very interesting in that man is the only animal on the planet that will discount his instinct.
I think you're right about that.
I mean, how many times have you gotten a funny feeling about something or saw something? You know, we see this in stalking cases a lot of times when we interview women who are victims, because in 85% of the cases, and it's predominantly women that are the victim.
Yeah.
And when we're chatting with them, we're talking to them about, you know, the situation and, you know, and what occurred and at what point did, you know, did it start to become creepy? And they'll inevitably tell you that, you know, I knew something wasn't right. You know, I had this feeling, but I discounted it and I entered into the building anyway, or I got into the elevator with that creep that I really shouldn't have gotten in with, or something along those lines. And, you know, you realize that, you know, as an animal, you have that capability, you know, you have that instinct that says what's right and what's not, and you get those feelings, and inevitably we wind up pushing through them. We go, it's just me being, you know, overreactive, or, you know, I don't need to do this, or, you know, what's the worst that could happen, and we wind up getting involved in it. So the long-winded answer for, you know, what should we be watching out for? If you see something, say something, but recognize what's going on around you. You know, a few months back there was a gunman that had committed an attack down by the Empire State Building in New York City.
Yeah.
And I got chided. I was on one of the local television stations talking about the situation. And I got chided on the station because one of the things that I had said was, you know, people in the neighborhood that were walking around there, you know, there were some victims that were just in the wrong place at the wrong time and became a victim. But there were a number of people that had been walking by that were really oblivious to what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I got chided by, you know, by the reporter and saying, you know, oh, come on, there's shooting going on. You know, how can anybody be oblivious? And later that night, on CNN, I believe, and I believe it was CNN, there was a woman, I believe it was on Piers Morgan, who was being interviewed, who said she was totally oblivious to what was going on because she had the iPod on.
Yeah.
And she was listening to music and was just daydreaming and just walked right into the middle of this.
Yeah.
And we see that so often, is that we just become oblivious to our surroundings. We see it in transportation crimes. People will sit near the exits of either the train or the bus, you know, by the exit doors, and we'll have, you know, the music in the ears blasting that you can hear it four seats away. They'll have the iPad opened up, and they're reading their email or doing, you know, looking at nuclear codes or whatever they're reading that's that important, and they'll have their bag down on the side of them. And the train doors will open up, and all of a sudden someone will come by, pick up the bag, and walk right off the train.
Yep.
They won't even realize it for two stops.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of self-awareness that becomes so critical. So that's the best thing that you can do, is, you know, sort of just become a little bit more aware of your surrounding, you know, have some situational awareness of where you're at, and, you know, just kind of pay attention.
You know, you hit on one of the key points, one of the downsides of this transition, as I describe in the cycles of time, of coming away from a physical industrial era into a more intellectual era. An upside might be we're entering an age of reason. Yeah, we're eventually getting there. But the downside is that we become more intellectually based, more virtual, more cyberspace oriented. We're becoming more insular. People walking down the streets, headphones, iPads, tablets, iPhones, not even more interested in what's going on inside of one's own head instead of what's going on around them. And in this age, that same world, virtual world that has these great bargains if you act online with free shipping also has the plans for the terrorism that's going to blow up the corner store when you walk in it or you in your home. So we've got to put things in a balanced perspective. You know, you mentioned, Sal, that man is the only creature that will ignore its own instincts. We're used to thinking that our mind is always the smartest thing. But there was a wonderful term that developed about 20 years ago called emotional intelligence, or just being aware and having instincts. Back in 2004, when there was the tragedy of a great tsunami, I heard many reports that of all the bodies that were found on the shores, they were all human beings, and there were no animals that were found drowned. Any animal that was big enough to get away was already gone before the tsunami hit us. They had the instincts that danger was there. They got out before it happened. Well, we may or may not have the instincts that to read the earth or the vibration or the magnetic field or whatever it was to tell us that a tsunami is coming in, but we sure have the instincts to recognize each other if we use them. So I thank you for this message, because you're reminding us, be aware, we have the tools within us to be aware, to recognize the danger when we're in proximity of it, and we have the reasoning capability to be more prepared for what can happen. Stock up on the food and the water in case you're going to be without power because of a natural or man-made disaster, and have let yourself be the first responder until the other first responders can get there. That's the second wave of first responders. The first one is yourself. Think before it happens so that you can respond instead of react. So, your stress is on education, and that what is education in the world of protecting ourselves is about? Is it about the threats? Is it more? What do you think we need to do to educate ourselves and each other?
Well, you know, I think, you know, again, it goes back to the realization of, you know, not being as insular as, you know, as you had put it. You know, it's kind of funny, you know, especially today with all of the social networking, you know, is really sort of a misnomer. You know, we're socially networked where, you know, you see people on Facebook and spouts like that and Twitter, and they'll have, you know, thousands of followers or hundreds of followers, and yet there's no personal relationship. And it's just kind of, you know, that's pretty interesting, you know, in my world. You know, we're supposed to be social, yet we're not very social in dealing with people.
Yeah.
But, you know, in dealing with the educational issues, it's, you know, anyone can create a plan. Having a plan in place is, you know, is sort of critical. And, you know, and again, you know, we have this tendency of moving to the quick, you know, kind of cut to the quick and be able to get a checklist to put together. But I think what you really need to be able to understand is that you need to understand how you're going to be reacting to the crises that are going to develop. You know, you can have a plan for hurricanes, and you can have a plan for, you know, blackouts and, you know, for any type of business interruptions. But the real test of the plan and the real metal of how you can get, how well you deal with that and how well you come out of that, which ultimately is what you want to do, right? It's not necessarily being able to effectively do the plan. You want this to be able to get over as fast as possible and mitigate any potential effects that may have upon you. So, you know, what you really want to be able to do is to understand and to learn techniques as to how to deal with the situations that are going to pop up that you haven't planned for. And inevitably, there are things that are going to occur you know, when you get into the weeds in these situations, there are things that are going to occur that you have never thought for and never planned for. Quickly, I will relate a story. Back in the day in OEM, we had a situation of a prolonged blackout in New York, and there was an area in the upper west side of Manhattan that had been in blackout for an extended period of time. And what we started to realize and learn and got reports on was that there was a core community there that didn't have the capability to be able to relocate. They couldn't get in a car and go to a hotel. You know, they were trapped. And all of the support mechanisms in place, all of the stores, the pharmacies, all of the things that would keep them supported and going on a day-to-day basis were also affected.
Yeah.
So what wound up happening was we had a core community of, you know, 30, 40,000 people that was starting to go hungry. And it was something that we had never planned for and never even thought of. I mean, you're in Manhattan in New York City. This isn't something that, you know, you would anticipate. And, you know, how we wound up getting through that was, you know, looking at, you know, problem solving sort of out of the box. So, you know, the thing that they need to understand and the things that you need to, you know, to realize is having a plan is great, but you need to be able to develop those techniques that are going to get you through those crises that you never planned for and never anticipated.
And the time to think about that and start planning is before it happens. So we have to learn the lessons from the past to understand where we are, to foresee where we may be going. This is the theme that I address time and time again. The very basis for the study of cycles itself is to understand where we were, so we know where we are. And if we know where we are, we can understand better where we're going and try to draw patterns out of that. And one thing that's certainly clear is the possibilities have been made brutally aware to us, the kind of things that we didn't expect. And now that we have learned what can happen and the mechanisms behind them, we realize we need to be more aware, stay attuned, localize our defenses, enact our preparedness ahead of time, and to learn a little bit. I've been learning a lot about this just by going around protectivecountermeasures.com. You have wonderful advisories on there on what to do on different cases. You address stalking, eavesdropping, and just a whole host of things that can affect anyone. And it's affected so many people, often by surprise. But you equip people through your advisements on what they can do about it. Now, I understand you have a book that may be coming up in the very near future here. Sal, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're pretty excited about it. It's called Connecting the Dots, and we're anticipating that we'll get it out published in February, this coming February. And basically what we've done is we've taken the techniques that we created back in the Office of Emergency Management in the intelligence operations, where we would look at threats and we would look at attacks that would take place around the world. We would look at who was responsible for it. We would then figure out, you know, were they operational within the New York area. We would look at threat information that we were receiving, and then based on all of that information, go to law enforcement and say, you know, this is what we're looking at, this is what we're seeing, you know, do you think this particular threat is viable? And if they would say, yeah, then what we would do is we would start looking at all of our resource allocation issues. What we're doing in the book is very similar. We're taking all of those techniques and, you know, processes that we had put together and learned over the years, put it into a book so that the average person reads a newspaper totally differently. You know, 95% of all intelligence information comes from open source. Everyone has the availability on their computer today to get the intelligence information. And we give them an actual process and program for them to be able to go through, to recognize threats, and to be able to plan for those particular threats that, if they were to occur and affect them, would get them through that process much quicker.
Well, I'm certainly going to be looking forward for this book coming out, and I know I'm getting a copy. Folks, if you want to keep tabs on this coming out, go to protectivecountermeasures.com where you can learn more about Salafrieri and Protective Countermeasures and Consulting Incorporated. And also, there's a telephone number right there on the homepage and throughout the site. Pick up the phone if you have a question. I understand that you're open for calls and queries. You also have a Contact Us link where people can just fill out a form, submit their question, and get an email reply. Isn't that true, Sal?
That's true, and we would love to hear some feedback, and those that are interested in the book can send us an email on the Contact Us, and when the book is published, we will be more than happy to reach out and send them a copy.
Well, there you are, folks. Don't just sit idly by waiting for the future to come. The future is here. We've been telling you in the cycles of change that the world has changed, and thanks to Mr. Sal LaFrieri of ProtectiveCountermeasures.com, we are addressing what you can do about it. Get involved and find a positive alternative and protect yourself and be in a position to reap the wonderful things that are coming as we rise. But we have to address the downside so that we're prepared for the worst and in a position for the best. Mr. LaFrieri, thank you for joining us tonight on the Cycles of Change radio program, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Had fun.
Good night, everyone. From the Cycles of Change radio program, I'm your host, David Katzmeier, signing out. Thank you.